'Twas the episode before Christmas, and all through the Golden Silent Films podcast home office, not a creature was stirring. Not even two cats. Wait! Strike that. The only creature stirring is me recording this holiday edition of the podcast. We hope you enjoyed this Yuletide episode, and a Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, Happy New Year, Happy Everything to everyone out there from your friends at the Golden Silent Films podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Winter Wonderland we lovingly call the Golden Silent Films podcast. Our crack research team has crunched the numbers and determined that all of you fine listeners out there are on the nice list this year. And because of that great news, we are sneaking this Christmas Silent Spectacular double feature of Seasonal Shenanigans episode under your podcast listening tree. Before we unwrap this little battle of the Jolly Fat Men, let's gift out the usual Golden Silent Films podcast social media roundup. As usual, follow Golden Silence Cast on Instagram for up-to-date info on our little operation here. And for everyone on Twitter, just follow at GoldenSilence1 or just search for Golden Silence Cast and you will find us. And these sites and screen names will be in the episode description in case you are interested in visiting us, and we would love to have you join in on the fun. At both social spaces, you'll get behind-the-scenes pics and info, upcoming episode information, and other fun and cool silent movie-related materials. And great photos of some Christmas-loving cats, for sure. Also, if you're listening to this program on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, please leave a review, a rating, or both. All those ratings and reviews help us get the show on the good list. Recently, the show just crossed the 5,000 listen mark, and we hope to keep that number moving up and up. We like to think we've been on Santa's good podcast list and would love nothing more than to wake up Christmas morning with a bunch of shiny new show reviews under our Christmas tree. Whether getting us more exposure in the world of podcasts or letting us know what we can do better, we appreciate the feedback and always endeavor to bring you the best show possible. And do subscribe to the Golden Silent Films podcast. Well, our output can be seemingly hit or miss. If you're subscribed, you will never miss an episode, and the moment we release new content, it will be downloaded right to your brain via your listening device of choice. We have a lot of cool stuff coming down the pipe. We are finishing up season 2 here. We got an awesome season 3 planned for everyone out there, and we do not want you to miss a second of it. Now, the two films we will be unwrapping this episode both come from a wonderful collection of silent Christmas-themed silence, a little redundant there, released by the always awesome Kino Video. The DVD set is called A Christmas Past, Vintage Holiday Films, 1901 to 1925. This collection brings together 9 shorts, all Christmas-related. Many of the flicks on here were produced at Thomas Edison's studios. You get a fun mix of slice-of-life films, Santa-centric shorts, and some adaptations, including A Christmas Carol and Twas the Night Before Christmas. The longest of the group clocks in at 29 minutes, so this DVD can be enjoyed in small bits or one feature-length binge session. According to the Kino description, the films have been digitally remastered from the original 35mm elements and are accompanied by a wistful new score by Al Kreizak, performed on a variety of instruments, including harp, violin, and Christmas handbells, which beautifully enhances the delicate shadings of each of these rare and fascinating treasures. Also, if you don't have the DVD, you can find these on the YouTube. Just search the movie titles that we talk about, and there are some out there. I know we have some posts to our Twitter. We have some links out there, so definitely check these out and come on back for some Christmas movie fun. So, now, the main event of this Yuletide film extravaganza is going to see us take a trip to the world-famous Edison Studios. But before we go all in on Santa Claus versus Cupid, let's enjoy a traditional family holiday pageant. Or maybe not enjoy? Now, we start our double feature with a trip back to 1901. This is, by far, the oldest movie we have covered here on the Golden Silent Films podcast. A holiday pageant at home, it's the movie we will be talking about first, and it was released in 1901. This particular short comes in at 5 minutes long. And this is so old, I really couldn't find much biographical or behind-the-scenes tales to regale you with about this one. And so, since I don't have much to say, let's just hop into the short that may or may not actually be holiday-related. Also, despite this not being the best representation of a cinematic Christmas, I wanted to go back further than any episode of the Golden Silent Films podcast before. Our previous record was 1915, which saw us cover two films from that year, Alice in Wonderland and The Cheat. And also, the film we're going to cover second, Santa Claus vs. Cupid, is also a 1915 film. So we couldn't pass up a chance to talk about a short from 1901. We open our double feature with a holiday pageant at home in big letters splashed across the screen. That is followed by the film telling us about it being a few days before Christmas. And these title cards are pretty much the main connection to Christmas this movie gives us, so we'll take their word for it. There is very little to this film, truth be told. I struggled to really figure out what was going on here. This seems to be more proof of concept of being a video Christmas card, 100 years before that was even a thing. It certainly feels like home movie footage of a family night back in 1901. And each little scene we got was clearly filmed in the same place. It would appear to be the inside of a house. There will be no camera movement of any sort throughout any of this. The first scene we get is a look at the whole family, minus Dad. The mother is working hard writing at a desk while one son is looking on. Presumably, she is writing the play that we will see momentarily. The other four children are in two sets of two, reading books in nearby chairs. The boy, watching his mother Wright moves over to read by his big sister. They all seem to be having a good time, so I guess that's a Christmassy kind of thing. Good times. I'm reaching and grasping at straws here, so we're going to keep on trucking through. At this point, the father enters. He is welcomed by all of the children. A hug and a kiss for everyone before heading over to the desk his wife is writing at. After giving her a kiss, she hands him what I think is the script of the titular pageant she was writing. He calls the children over to give it a look. So far, they're all very excited. They all like what they see, and the film rolls on. The next scene we are told is Christmas Eve, the prologue. For this segment, two of the girls put on some kind of rudimentary show for their parents. I guess it's a song and dance of some sort. Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies, this is not, folks. It's a weird skit or something that turns into a dance by two children who don't seem too excited about this whole venture. The parents, though, are really, really digging it. They give a hearty round of applause after the event. The next segment introduced to us is the play. When I first saw this, I thought this was going to be your usual manger scene or the nativity or some Santa-centric tale the artsy mother had put together. Perhaps some imagination would be baked into this, and I'd be totally surprised and awestruck with holiday wonder. Well, at the very least, I can say I was surprised. Not only do we get the returns of the two girls from the previous segment, but we get the additions of all the rest of the children in this not-so-theatrical production. The one girl seems to be being yelled at by the other children for some reason, and those children berating the girl are dressed like adults. Trust me, this doesn't make much more sense when you watch it. The little girl is crying as these jerks yell and point and get into her face. I tried to make up seasonal reasons why they were verbally abusing her. Perhaps she forgot to buy Christmas presents. Maybe she was a maid who had burned the family's beloved figgy pudding, thus ruining Christmas. Sure, those all sound plausible, but those imaginary backstories became meaningless when the next character emerged. We get an even smaller boy emerging from stage right wearing a cowboy costume, complete with a gun and Bowie knife. At this point, I threw up my hands and said to myself, what the hell is even going on? How does the introduction of a cowboy fit the overall theme of this holiday pageant? Your guess is as good as mine, everybody. But let's continue. He comes up behind the yelling couple and puts the gun and knife right in their faces. The lady screams and runs off with her, I guess, husband, brother, child not far behind. The gun-toting cowboy chases them in a circle around the furniture as the original girl that was being jeered and yelled at, claps and cheers him on. Around and around they go until they eventually drop to their knees and beg for mercy. With a knife in their faces, the cowboy seems unwilling to bargain. The girl is still cheering and clapping behind him as he threatens to kill these town folk. End scene. The last scene of this quasi-holiday pageant is the author's reward, in which the mother is sewing until the father comes in and shakes her hand and gives her a kiss before pulling up a chair and sitting down next to her. She puts down her sewing stuff as the husband hugs her and gifts this talented playwright with some, I guess, holiday smooches. The end. Now that was quite a holiday wild ride, complete with traditional festive cowboy and less than enthusiastic musical number by unhappy children. Now that we got that movie out of the way, let's turn our attention to an actual Christmas-themed short produced at the famous Edison Film Manufacturing Corporation. Before we get too festive and start hitting the eggnog a little too hard, let's look back at that legendary film studio. As our focus now turns to Santa Claus vs. Cupid, let's dive into where it was made. Now, the first film production facility for Edison was far away from the future home of film in Hollywood, and at the time was in the movie capital of the early 1900s, beautiful, scenic New Jersey. Though the actions of Edison and company would set the wheels in motion of sending the movie business westward, let's learn about that original setup in Jersey. A constant flow of new film subjects was needed to keep the new invention popular, so a motion picture production studio was built at West Orange in December of 1892. It was dubbed the Black Maria on account of its resemblance to a police patrol wagon. The studio had a roof that could be opened to admit sunlight for illumination, and the building itself was mounted on a revolving pivot so that the structure could be constantly repositioned to keep it aligned with the sun, according to the Library of Congress. But how did Edison become the central cinematic hub of these early days of the medium? Writer Garrett O'Brien explains in an article entitled Thomas Edison, the Unintentional Founder of Hollywood, written for the Saturday Evening Post. O'Brien writes, although Edison himself patented the kinetoscope movie viewer in 1891, it was developed by one of his assistants, William Kennedy Dixon. Dixon and Edison invented what so many had tried before them, a moving picture. The invention was meant to help promote Edison's phonograph, generating a larger use of the sound technology. However, the ability to synchronize sound to motion pictures was harder than expected. This led to a rise of the silent film. As a result of the invention of the kinetoscope movie projector and the kinetograph movie camera, Edison opened America's first movie studio, Black Maria. Now that first production facility, the Black Maria in West Orange, New Jersey, was built in the winter of 1892 and early 1893. Despite the historic run within the confines of the Black Maria, though, the Edison Company wasn't the kind of operation to stay stagnant for too long. As technology progressed and new ideas emerged, the Black Maria's era came to an end in early 1901 when Edison inaugurated a new glass-enclosed studio on a rooftop in New York. Now, the second facility they built sounds super cool and super rad from an appearance perspective. It was a glass-enclosed rooftop studio built at 41 East 21st Street in Manhattan's Entertainment District. It officially opened for business in 1901, but by 1907, the Edison gang was already putting together new facilities, beginning construction on Decatur Avenue and Oliver Place in the Bedford Park neighborhood of the Bronx. Now, some of these first commercially exhibited motion pictures in the United States were products of the Edison Studio System and premiered at a kinetoscope parlor in New York City on April 14, 1894. This program was comprised of 10 short films, with each being less than a minute long. They were films of athletes, dancers, other performers. After competitors began exhibiting their films on screens, Edison introduced its own projecting kinetoscope in late 1896. Now, these early forays into film were mostly just movies of people doing everyday stuff, but on camera. As the medium expanded and more people tried their hand at it, advances in storytelling and visuals pushed the Edison Company to incorporate more story-centric ideas into their films. In fact, by 1904, a great majority of their film sales were story films. Now, the movie world took a turn for the more litigious in 1908, with Edison and company leading the charge. Turning back to Garrett O'Brien, we can see what a force Edison was, for good or bad, in the movie-making world. O'Brien writes, Edison formed an alliance among other major patent holders in the industry. It was known as the Motion Picture Patents Company, MPPC, or, more colloquially, the Edison Trust. The trust included a competing production company that Dixon founded, Biograph, which held its own camera patent, as well as Eastman Kodak, the biggest producer of raw film. Given how many patents the cartel covered, it was virtually impossible for any independent movie studio to make a film without being bombarded by copyright infringement lawsuits from the MPPC. 289 legal complaints were directed at Universal Studios alone. Any movie being made at the time had to go through Edison, making him the king of the movie industry. But that vice grip on non-Edison-affiliated filmmakers would end up having long-term financial and geographic effects on the business. This onslaught of lawsuits and litigation made movie making near impossible, which ended up stifling creativity and holding back innovation. This led filmmakers to run far away from the East Coast and Edison and his movie monopoly. This is when Hollywood enters the story, and the groundwork is laid for a future of a West Coast movie industry hub. But that is a tale for another day. We are here to celebrate the holidays. But pertinent to our story at hand, though, the Motion Picture Patents Company and the General Film Company were indeed found guilty of antitrust violations in October 1915 and were dissolved. The court struck down the MPPC, saying that a patentee may simply enforce his right to exclude infringement, but he must not use his patent as a weapon to disable a rival contestant or to drive him from the field, for he cannot justify such use. So basically, Edison's monopoly was busted up by the Sherman Antitrust Act. That would be the beginning of the end. That breakup and the loss of European markets during World War I would prove bad for business. Edison sold its film business off, including the Bronx studio, on March 30th, 1918, to the Lincoln and Parker Film Company of Massachusetts. So, with the where of Santa Claus versus Cupid covered, let's talk about who is responsible for writing this short. And that would be Alan Crosland. Now, if that name sounds familiar, you would be correct. A couple episodes ago, we did discuss Don Juan, and the director of that swashbuckler was, you guessed it, Alan Crosland. For a more in-depth dive into his life, cue up that Don Juan episode and enjoy tales of the director's wider life and works. But as far as this film is concerned, let's first dig into his time at the famous Edison Studios. Now, Crosland began his motion picture career working for Thomas A. Edison Incorporated in 1912. Like many others, he started out as a jack of all trades, doing whatever needed to be done on set. He put in his time on many sets and had a wonderful filmmaking experience that he logged up to add to his resume. This hard work and value on set was recognized when he was promoted to film director in 1916. He made his way up through the ranks in the company from directing shorts to making feature productions. Now, Crosland would work within the Edison studio system through the end of its life as a movie producing entity. On that front, Crosland even directed the final Edison film, 1918's The Unbeliever. Secondly, if you remember in our earlier biography of Alan Crosland, we talked about his early writing career. In fact, one of his earliest jobs was as a writer for the New York Globe newspaper. That gig would only last so long before he turned his interest to acting, which he excelled at. As an actor, he acted in quite a few productions and definitely provided great experience that would inform his future directing ambitions. Now, on the writing side of the ledger, I was only able to find 3 credits to Crosland's name. Oddly enough, Santa Claus vs. Cupid seems to be his first writing credit, which came out in 1915. He followed that up with writing the scenario for 1917's The Light in Darkness, and 5 years later he would write the screenplay for 1922's Why Announce Your Marriage. So, with that biographical discourse out of the merry way, let's celebrate our show's first foray into the holiday season and celebrate our inaugural silent movie Christmas extravaganza. Well, Santa Claus vs. Cupid was released on December 8th, 1915, and this short comes in at a slim trim 16-ish minutes. Now, Santa Claus vs. Cupid, A Christmas Story, was written by Alan Crosland and directed by Will Lewis. As the credits roll, we are introduced to our two leads, Jack Norwood, played by Raymond McKee, and Edward Beck, played by Bill Casey. Both men are looking into a dresser mirror, pining over the same girl, Helen. Both seem to be very happy. Whilst they seem happy, we find out that the spirit of Christmas cheer does not enter the home of one Binks Mulligan. Here we find out Binks is played by Guido Colucci, and Miss Mulligan is played by Edith Wright. Let's pause for a moment and talk about the man behind Master Thief Binks Mulligan. That would be Guido Colucci, who, as best I could find, was born in Florence, Italy in 1892. Info about Colucci was sparse, but he had 25 acting credits to his name, according to IMDb.com. He appeared in 13 shorts, including today's Santa Claus vs. Cupid in 1915 alone. The last film credit I could find for Colucci came in 1922, and that seemed to be it for the occasional actor. He passed away in 1974 in Paris, France. Binks is with his sick wife and children. He wants his family to have a great Christmas and says a prayer before heading out. We find out Binks is a chauffeur, taxi driver kind of guy with a horse-drawn carriage. Next, we jump over to Helen, the lady friend that Jack and Edward were both fawning over, and we find out she's having a Christmas party and needs help chaperoning it and wants there to be a Santa. Jack thinks this is his chance to make a great impression, but first, he is going to get Helen some flowers. He goes to the florist and gets some specially arranged flowers for his sweetheart. With a perfect bouquet in hand, he heads over and delivers it personally. Or does he? Upon arriving, he is intercepted by Edward, who talks him out of the possession of those flowers, which he, Edward, promptly takes inside and hand delivers to Helen. Of course, he says they were his idea and his alone. What a goon. A total maroon, if you will. Needless to say, she loves the flowers that old Jackie boy bought, but Edward delivered as his own. As the maid is putting them in a vase, something falls out. It seems Edward forgot to remove the greeting card thing from the flowers. The thing that says who they're from. I don't know if that's got an official name. But it says they are from Jack, and the maid pockets the note, realizing that something is a little off. Jack eventually makes his way into the house, but the butler tells him he'll have to wait if he wants to see Helen. He says he'll wait, but Edward realizes Jack has come in and sneaks Helen out of the house with him. While waiting, Jack comes up with a great idea. He's going to impress Helen by dressing up as a Santa for her big Christmas shindig. He soon finds a charity Santa outside collecting money. And so to this charity Santa, he offers to buy his outfit. They wheel, they deal, but finally Jack makes the right offer, if you will. And with suit in hand, Jack rushes home to change. We are now at the party and a ton of kids are playing around the Christmas tree. Outside the well-to-do manor, that cabbie chauffeur, Binks Mulligan, is out with the other drivers. Helen wants them to be looked after, too. We also find out, again, Edward has beaten Jack to the punch. He is already dressed up as Santa and is about to make all the little kiddies super happy. While the other drivers are getting a nice hot meal, Binks is being, for lack of a better word, a grumposaurus, thinking about his home situation and inability to provide a great holiday for his family. As he sits and pouts, his children's list to Santa falls out of his pocket. He reads it. It reads, "Please bring us an aeroplane, a little horse, and a doll. Oh, and Santy dear, also please bring Mother a medicine for her health. Thanks. Signed, Mary and what appears to be Jammy and Fred. And P.S. Bring Pop a blank." While this was a fun and creative letter, it was written wildly. The spelling was atrocious, which I understand is to show their poor and uneducated family. But it was written so crazy, I needed to pause a couple times and have someone else help decipher some of the words. It was weird. And the screen cut off the bottom bit, so we don't know yet what they want Pops to get from Santa. It took a fair amount of work for me to figure it out, so kudos and much respect to the crowds of ye olden day movie theaters who were able to read this right off the bat, because I certainly was unable to. Now, reading this letter sends Binks Mulligan over the edge. He sneaks off from dinner, intent on taking matters into his own poor hands. Now, Jack is smoking a cigarette at home, awaiting the start of the party to bring cheer to all the boys and girls, and ultimately win the heart of Helen. He hasn't heard anything yet and is getting antsy and smoky as he waits, and he waits, and he waits. And as he's waiting, though, he pulls out a small box with a ring. He is going to give it to Helen. What a sweet, sweet boy. But we also have to return our attention to that jerk, Edward, who is upstairs already at Helen's place. He is also dressed as Santa and awaiting the signal to bring holiday cheer to all those boys and girls as well. But not so fast, though. Binks Mulligan is desperate, and desperate men are dangerous. And to prove that, he has broken into Edward's changing room and holds him up at gunpoint. Edward thinks it's a joke at first, but it is not. And Binks locks Edward in the closet. That dastardly Binks Mulligan takes Edward's sack of goodies and toys and tosses it out the second story window. It's not a proper heist, though, without an exhilarating getaway. Binks climbs down the side of the house just as Jack arrives. He sees what is going on and is appalled. He chases Binks and a scuffle breaks out. It doesn't last long, though, before Binks breaks down and confesses everything to Jack. He even has him read the letter to Santa from earlier. It's so dark out that Jack takes Binks and the letter to a nearby car whose headlights are on. He reads the sad letter from the Binklings. Jack gets very contemplative and hands the letter back to Binks. Back inside, Edward is still locked in the closet. He hears the gong signifying the time to arrive, all merry and whatnot, but as he's locked up in the closet, he cannot arrive. Outside, though, Jack pulls out a wad of cash and hands it to the desperate father. Binks can't stop smiling. Jack is definitely on Santa's good list with this little action, and Binks hands Jack the key to the closet. He takes it with a wry smile on his face. Jack also takes the sack of gifts and makes his way into the house. The children go absolutely bonkers for Santa. He dishes out gifts left and right. It is the perfect Christmas. And to make things more perfect, we cut back to the Mulligan household, where the kids are playing with cool toys and Mom is getting her much-needed medicine. Back at the party house, Jack gives the key to the maid and tells her about Edward. She takes the key and hands him the card from the flowers. They both give a knowing smile. Helen then enters to hug Santa, thinking it's Edward, but she realizes it's Jack and not Edward. But because Edward is a jerk, she is super happy about this turn of events and gives Jack a huge kiss. Eventually, Edward makes his way out before Jack tells him, "Allow me to present the new Mr. and Mrs. Claus." Edward is fuming. Enjoying the turned tables, Jack adds, "Wait, the wedding date isn't settled, but send roses." That callback was too much for Edward, and he leaves post haste as the two lovebirds kiss. The end. Before we officially end the festivities, though, let's unwrap one last biography waiting under the tree for us. What we have before us is a case of good, respectful Santa up against a couple of humbug Santas. Let's celebrate that good Santa by taking a quick glimpse into the life of Jack Norwood himself, Raymond McKee. Now, Eldon Raymond McKee was born on December 7th, 1892, in the delightfully fun-to-say town of Keokuk, Iowa. He got his showbiz start on Broadway before trying his hand at the moving pictures. Early on, he was making his name with the Edison and Lubin studios before joining up with Max Sennett. During the filming of 1918's The Unbeliever, McKee worked with his future wife, actress Marguerite Courteau. The two would work together again in the 1922 production of Down to the Sea in Ships. They got married the next year, on April 14th to be exact, and it was a long-lasting marriage that lasted nearly 60 years, ending only with McKee's death. From 1926 to 1928, he portrayed the character of Jimmy Smith in a series of 29 Smith family comedy films. These silent films were released at a rate of roughly one a month as one reel fillers. After retiring from acting, McKee focused his attention on the Zulu Hut, a restaurant that he originally opened in Los Angeles in the 1920s. McKee died on October 3, 1984, at the age of 91, in Long Beach, California, from pneumonia. As a United States Army veteran, his gravesite is at the Riverside National Cemetery in Riverside, California, with his wife Marguerite was buried alongside him 2 years later. With the movie finished, and since this movie was about gift-giving, and this episode is being released during the gift-giving season, I suppose I should give my thoughts on this Santa-filled flick. Now, as we start this review section of the show, my first gripe will be a small, but crucial one. I felt a bit let down that Cupid never makes an appearance. In a world where we've gotten Freddy vs. Jason, Batman vs. Superman, Jean-Claude vs. Dolph, I was naive enough to think that this was the first movie crossover slash battle. But alas, it is not. And we are left with just a basic Santa v. Santa, which is not a bad thing, but I was hoping for a little more crossover action. Another thing I was totally not vibing with was the music. The other shorts on this disc, don't get me wrong, all had really good music. But Santa vs. Cupid did nothing for me. It all sounded very experimental with sharp notes from a violin. There's really nothing Christmassy about it at all, and it made a generally charming film really agitating and hard to deal with. This needs new music. A couple of the times I watched it, I muted the television just to avoid the score. Again, the music was nearly unlistenable. I never seek out negativity, and in general, on this show, I always find the good in something. But I can't with this music. I just can't. Literally can't. Outside of that, I generally felt this movie was pretty solid. The performances were on point and the story moved along at a great clip. But maybe too good of a clip. Let me explain. So on the positive side of things, as a general concept, I loved Santa Claus vs. Cupid. Once you take the movie out of its incredibly convoluted wrapping paper, there is a charming story at the core. In fact, I feel this basic concept and story would actually make a pretty solid Lifetime television Christmas movie. Santa Claus vs. Cupid has everything you want. You got love triangles, deception, drama, redemption, and the always appreciated Happy Christmas ending. When you watch the movie through, a lot of the plot tends to get lost in the storytelling. The first time I watched it, I was really confused. The film moved so fast with so few intertitles. This fast pacing caused me to miss some of the finer points of the narrative. It tended to get a bit convoluted and confusing as the story unfolded. A few rewinds and rewatches definitely helped in making everything fit together. The story totally could have been repurposed and remade as a feature-length picture, no doubt. A lot of the confusing stuff could be addressed and run smoother with 60 minutes or more to fill. And the performances were really good and achieved what they set out to do. I wasn't the only one to see the positives and the negatives of the plot, however. Let's hear from J.B. Kaufman, who wrote a review of Santa Claus vs. Cupid for his film website, www.jbkaufman.com. Now, Kaufman writes, "And in fact, the scenario is the most remarkable ingredient in Santa Claus vs. Cupid. This may be a one-reel film, but Crossland packs into that short running time a wealth of plot and incident that could sustain a much longer film. With almost reckless extravagance, Crossland crams all this story material into one reel and challenges us to keep up with it. It's been observed elsewhere that early cinema made singular demands on its viewers, Nickelodeon audiences having developed a practiced eye by 1915, seem to have followed this profuse narrative with no difficulty, but today's viewer may want to watch the film several times in order to catch everything. Now, with movie chat out of the way, there is no better way to celebrate Christmas than with death, which can mean only one thing." As we lay this episode to rest, it is time to find out where your favorite silent stars are laid to rest. This is the segment where we join our favorite cinematic storytellers on the other side of the cemetery gates. The history, the arts, the celebrity spectacle converge. And where are they now? Your guide to paying your respects to the stars that have entertained us so much. Alan Crosland passed away on July 16, 1936 at the young age of 41 as a result of an automobile accident on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles, California. Early in the morning on July 10, 1936, Crosland was driving on Sunset Boulevard when his car hit road debris, causing him to swerve off the road, flipping twice in a construction zone. He was rushed to the hospital with multiple broken bones and a suspected skull fracture. Within 4 days, he had contracted pneumonia and his condition was downgraded by his doctor. He died on July 16, 1936, just shy of his 42nd birthday. His last film, 1936's The Case of the Black Cat, was finished up by William C. McGann. Crosland was survived by his son with first wife Juanita Fletcher. That son was Alan Crosland Jr., who had an incredibly talented and successful television directorial career in the 60s and 70s. Crosland, like many notable folks we talk about here, was buried in the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. If you are curious as to the exact spot, look no further than the Garden of the Exodus, Row 7, Grave 727S. With that out of the way, we wrap this episode up with a nice bow and we head back to the North Pole. We want to thank you all out there for sharing this holiday adventure with us. Since Christmas is one of our favorite holidays, it was so much fun to finally talk about a Christmas movie or two on the podcast. Did you enjoy this festive fight between holiday heavyweights? What are some of your favorite holiday-themed films and pictures? What fantasy folk do you want to see fight in a silent movie? Let us know all of that and more at the various social media hangouts of the Golden Silent Films podcast. On that note, if you have forgotten, we are on Instagram and Twitter. Let us know what you think about this episode. What movies, past or present, do you want us to dive into next? Our world of silence is constantly expanding, and we need your input to plan out our future views. This is the end of the year, folks. This is the end of 2022, and it is the season finale, the second season finale of the show. So we want to know what you want us to cover going forward. And you can do all that at Golden Silence Cast on Instagram and at Golden Silence 1 on Twitter. And again, if you listen to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other podcast outlet that allows it, subscribe, rate, review. It helps us like crazy, and we love hearing your thoughts. We super, super appreciate all your awesome support, and seeing how much you folks out there are listening only makes us want to make bigger and better episodes for all of you. And that is a wrap of the second season of the Golden Silent Films podcast. A huge thank you to all of you listeners for all of your fine listening and sticking through us through two seasons of silent film fun. And as always, don't forget, the silents are golden, and the talkies, they're just a fad. See you all in 2023.